Okay, it's time for us to start. Open up to Joshua chapter 7, please. Joshua chapter 7. We got three chapters up to bat tonight, 7, 8, and 9. And so let's dive right in. We got a lot to cover. In chapter 6, last week we talked about Jericho. The walls fell down. The people were able to conquer the city through God's miraculous intervention. And God had told them at that time, do not covet the stuff you see in there. Don't steal it. Don't take it. Don't plunder it. All that metal, gold, silver, bronze, iron, all that stuff is going to go into the treasury of the Lord. That was the rule. Chapter 6, verses 17 through 19. But look what happened. Chapter 7, verse 1. The sons of Israel acted unfaithfully in regard to the things under the band. For Achan, son of Carmi, son of Zabdi, son of Zerah, from the tribe of Judah, took some of the things under the band. Therefore, the anger of the Lord burned against the sons of Israel. Achan violates the ban, they don't realize it. Joshua doesn't realize it, and so he is proceeding to the next battle. So the next town to be conquered is a small one named Ai, but Israel loses. In verse 4, so about 3,000 men from the people went up there, but they fled from the men of Ai. The men of Ai struck down about 36 of their men and pursued them from the gate as far as the Shebarim and struck them down on the descent. So the hearts of the people melted and became as water. Then Joshua tore his clothes and fell to the earth on his face before the ark of the Lord until the evening, both he and the elders of Israel, and they put dust on their heads. Joshua said, alas, O Lord God, why did you ever bring this people over the Jordan, only to deliver us into the hand of the Amorites to destroy us? If only we had been willing to dwell beyond the Jordan. O Lord, what can I say since Israel has turned their back before their enemies? For the Canaanites and all the inhabitants of the land will hear of it, and they will surround us and cut off our name from the earth. And what will you do for your great name? So interesting response from Joshua. At least to me, it shocks me how he responds. I think it shows us something about how fragile he is still feeling. This is after the victory at Jericho. He knows that God is with him, but then all of a sudden they lose a battle. So really, small town, and it really shakes him. And I think that shows us his fragility at this point. The fact is they're still camped in the middle of nowhere in these tents, and you got all the enemies all around them. They're in hostile territory, people in walled cities, big old people that would scare you from a military standpoint, and they feel vulnerable, and now they've lost a battle. And so Joshua's response here, I think, shows a little of that. Kind of fear that's been at bay for a bit. So Joshua doesn't know that Israel is the problem. He doesn't realize their sin. So he's asking God, why have you done it? But God's not broken the covenant. Israel has, as is going to become very apparent. Now, to Joshua's credit, he takes this to God in prayer. He's talking directly to God here. He's not turning to idols. He's not trying to make an alliance with the Philistines or something, let's go defeat Ai together. None of that. He's going straight to God with his concerns, which is what he ought to do. And this is going to be resolved. And so in verse 13, rise up, consecrate the people and say, consecrate yourselves for tomorrow. For thus says the Lord, the God of Israel has said, there are things under the ban in your midst. O Israel, you cannot stand before your enemies until you've removed the things under the ban from your midst. So here's a couple of sites that might be Ai. I guess there's some ruins there, and they're not sure which one of those might be Ai, but there's a couple of possible locations, and God is getting involved. He's going to get to the bottom of this, maybe this almost gives us a sneak peek into the final judgment day, or at least the way God's handling this situation is. We're going to call everybody before. He's going to take them by lot, and narrow it down and get to Achan, and he's going to stand before everybody and answer for what he's done. And so verse 15, it shall be that the one who is taken with the things under the ban shall be burned with fire, he and all that belongs to him, because he has transgressed the covenant of the Lord and because he has committed a disgraceful thing in Israel. And so that is harsh. But God always does what's right and what's just. And so we know he's doing the right thing here. The command had been clear. This is the ban. You don't touch any of that stuff. Achan had clearly violated what God had commanded, and so now he's going to face a severe punishment for that. Okay, that's the first part of this event, first 15 verses. Any comments? Any questions so far? The sin of Achan. Interesting event here. JR?
All right. Up to this point, well, before they go to Ai, they don't lose anybody.
Don't lose anybody?
Yes.
I don't think so. I mean, they conquered Jericho. It doesn't say anybody died or anything until we get to these 36.
Very well fortified, as we know. To not lose anybody, even one, in battle is pretty amazing. So even though we think maybe God's punishment here is harsh, what God was giving them, a battle with no casualties on their side,
That's true.
That's a big deal.
Yeah, that's true.
So now you violated it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And so he's going to purge the evil from the land, as we're going to see here in the next passage. Good point. What else? Okay, let's look at the next section here, 16 through 26, when Achan is punished. So verses 16, 17, 18, God narrows it down until it finally gets to Achan, who is selected. Then verse 19, then Joshua said to Achan, "My son, I implore you, give glory to the Lord, the God of Israel, and give praise to him. Tell me now what you've done. Do not hide it from me." So Achan answered Joshua and said, "Truly, I have sinned against the Lord, the God of Israel, and this is what I did. When I saw among the spoil a beautiful mantle from Shinar, and 200 shekels of silver, and a bar of gold, 50 shekels in weight, then I coveted them and took them. And behold, they are concealed in the earth inside my tent with the silver underneath it." Okay, so to his credit, he fully confesses it. Of course, he waited until it got narrowed down and God is pointing the finger at him to come clean. But he admits what he's done. And by the way, you notice the progression of his sin there. He saw, he coveted, he took, he concealed. Many sermons have been preached from those four words. And it's a good reminder to us about the progression that sin often takes. It's that very thing. Think of David and Bathsheba. Wasn't it those four things? He saw her, he coveted her, he took her, and he tried to conceal the whole thing with Uriah and everything else. And maybe if we look at our lives, we see that same progression a number of times. There's something that we saw, some sin that, the opportunity for some sin, and we started thinking about that, coveting it perhaps, and then we go do it, and then after that we're embarrassed and ashamed and we try to hide what we've done. So this is a common experience among human beings, and it's just a reminder. As we read his story and he's openly confessing this progression, it's just a reminder to us. I mean, the best time to stop a sin is right at the beginning. If you can stop it during the Saul part, right at the beginning, obviously that's the thing that we ought to be doing. It may be we see something or we start thinking of something, and there's no good that's going to come of that. For example, wonder what it would be like to have that person as my spouse. You're already married, and you start thinking about there's nothing good that's going to come following that train of thought. Right? Just stop it right there and think of something else. Or wonder what it'd be like to punch that guy in the mouth next time he says that. Or whatever it is, right there when that starts is when we need to cut it off before it progresses to anything else, especially action. So there's some trains of thought. We just need to stop them right at the beginning. So Achan's story, I think, is a good illustration in the progression of sin and how we need to stop it as soon as possible. Let me pause there. Any further comments on any of that? Ma'am?
Anything from God.
Sure.
And that's a lesson. And also, consequences for his family. When we sin, we don't always know what the consequences will be for others around us.
Okay, yeah, that's right. It's, I forget how that saying goes now, but sin takes you further than you wanted to go, makes you pay more than you wanted to pay, and so forth. And that's right. And there's going to be some consequences for his family. And I don't know what involvement his family may have had. We're not told at all. But his family is going to be part of the punishment here, as we're about to read. Wyatt?
This is the same pattern that James describes in 1 James 1:14-15.
Okay.
Each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. That's, I saw it, I coveted it.
Yeah.
The lust, when it is conceived, gives birth to sin. I took it, I concealed it. And when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. In this case, literal death.
Okay.
Joshua 7, 25 and 26, we haven't gotten there yet.
Okay. Yeah, that's exactly right. James 1 is a good parallel to what we're talking about here. Somebody else have a hand up? Sir?
This is a case that not only AI, but adult members of the household should have known better to begin with, but also they had gotten a warning very recently. Chapter 6, verses 18 and 19 says directly, don't do this.
Yeah.
Don't do any of this.
Right.
You keep your hands off the stuff there.
Yeah. This is not a case of I didn't know or, oh, well, you told us one time 20 years ago. No, we told you the day of, don't touch anything. And he goes and does it. And he knows it's wrong because he's hiding it in his tent. So it's not like he didn't know. So it's a direct sin, deliberate sin, and he's punished severely. Look at verse 22, Joshua 7, 22. So Joshua sent messengers, and they ran to the tent, and behold, it was concealed in his tent with the silver underneath it. They took him from inside the tent and brought them to Joshua and to all the sons of Israel, and they poured them out before the Lord. Then Joshua and all Israel with him took Achan the son of Zerah, the silver, the mantle, the bar of gold, his sons, his daughters, his oxen, his donkeys, his sheep, his tent, and all that belonged to him. And they brought them up to the valley of Achor. Joshua said, why have you troubled us? The Lord will trouble you this day. And all Israel stoned them with stones, and they burned them with fire after they had stoned them with stones. They raised over him a great heap of stones that stands to this day. And the Lord turned from the fierceness of his anger. Therefore, the name of that place has been called the Valley of Achor to this day. Okay, so this was immediate and severe punishment. And you see there how the whole thing, tent included, is taken and covered up with stones and burned and it's gone. Now, why was his family stoned? It mentions his sons and daughters. I don't know if he had a wife or not, but sons and daughters, why were they included? We're not told. I don't know. It just says that they were part of the punishment. I don't know how old they were. I don't know if they were part of this. Did they help him carry the stuff out of Jericho, or did they not do that, but they knew? I mean, I don't know how, if he had his own tent, or, you know, how do you not know stuff's buried in under the tent there? I don't know what it was, if they were complicit in sin or not, or if this was just a consequence because of his sin. I don't know. Go back to Deuteronomy chapter 13. Here's a principle that I think is worth considering that we recently studied when we went through the book of Deuteronomy. God's laws were very strict. And here in Deuteronomy 13, the context is if somebody's trying to get you to come and worship other gods, they're trying to pull you away from the one true God, let's go worship some other gods. And he said, you need to expose that, reveal that. I don't care if it's your closest family members. You need to expose that. Deuteronomy 13 and verse 6, if your brother, your mother's son or daughter or the wife you cherish or your friend who's as your own soul entice you secretly saying, let us go and serve other gods whom neither you nor your fathers have known, of the gods of the peoples who are around you, near you, or far from you, from one end of the earth to the other end, you shall not yield to him or listen to him, and your eyes shall not pity him, nor shall you spare or conceal him, but you shall surely kill him. Your hand shall be first against him to put him to death, and afterwards the hand of all the people. So you shall stone him to death because he has sought to seduce you from the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Then all Israel will hear and be afraid and will never again do such a wicked thing among you. So if that's the law God had for that particular situation, then you can imagine that any sin, you know, God doesn't want this to be something that influences the rest of the camp. And sin ought to be exposed and dealt with immediately. And so it may have been that Achan had grown children who at least knew about the stuff in his tent and didn't expose the sin, and that's why God included them in the consequence. But the fact of the matter is, we're not told, so I don't know. That's conjecture. Wyatt?
Let's say he and everything that belongs to him, so maybe they weren't married off yet.
Okay. Yeah. Mark?
People try to make a point before that the God of the Old Testament, the God of the New Testament seem like two different gods. You know, in the New Testament, we hear about forgiveness and love. And in the Old Testament, God is punishing these people very severely, as we see here with Achan. But I think what you have to keep in mind is even Jesus treated different people differently depending on where they were in their faith. And some people needed to be dealt with very strongly, and some people needed to be dealt with compassionately. And we see over and over again that the Israelites would easily go astray. I mean, they were just barely hanging on to the right path. And so when they start getting a little bit off, you know, I kind of think of it like a school teacher. You know, if you have a very unruly class, you have to really be on top of them to keep order in that classroom. But once they have matured, then you can be a little bit more fun. You can show a little more grace and forgiveness. You can show that kind of thing once the people are at that point. And I think that this God's behavior here just shows where the people were at.
That's right. I mean, this is the beginning of the conquest, and this certainly makes a statement. You can imagine the way everybody else is going to react to this, and you'd be on notice. God's taking this seriously. J.D.?
David's sin with Bathsheba, the child died. That was David's punishment. And that's a pattern that we see, is that God... I can see it for myself, too. If I get hurt by my own sin, I deserve it. It's almost not punishment, it's just justice.
Yeah.
But if my family gets hurt, people I love get hurt, that's a punishment to me.
Yeah, that's true. And that reminds me of when David took that unauthorized census, and it was the same thing where God sweeps down with a plague, and lots of people were hurt because of that. So, and again, from the eternal perspective, God's looking at this, and when he sweeps innocent people into eternity like that, cuts life short, in other words, kills them, then, you know, their souls, he's taking care of their souls in eternity, and that's all going to work out okay. But certainly makes a statement here to everybody else. Whether these were innocent or guilty sons and daughters here of Achan, the statement is certainly made. Sin's not going to be tolerated. Angel?
A lot of times with sin, it's selfish. There's no regard for what's going to happen outside of yourself or, you know, other
people. Sure, yeah.
They have no idea how far-ranging going to go.
Yeah, and this is an interesting, we think, well, Achan, what were you thinking? You know, how is this, how are you going to keep this secret? You know, they're going to be on the move soon. You're going to dig it up and carry it. You know, but that's the way sin is. It doesn't make sense, and it's not logical. We just do it. Okay, look in. Go ahead.
You know, he was saying that some people say there's a different God, but, you know, you think about Ananias and Sapphira.
Yeah.
Same thing.
Same
situation. Same God.
Yeah. Immediate death for Ananias and Sapphira. Look at chapter 8. We're going to try this again. Let's try to attack Ai again. Verses 1 and 2. Now the Lord said to Joshua, "Do not fear or be dismayed. Take all the people of war with you and arise. Go up to Ai. See, I have given into your hands the king of Ai, his people, his city, and his land. You shall do to Ai and its king just as you did to Jericho and its king. You shall take only its spoil and its cattle and plunder for yourselves. Set an ambush for the city behind it." Okay, so you see kind of a map up here. Here's Jericho where they're camped at Gilgal. This is kind of their headquarters right now. And you got 5,000 are going to go to the west of Ai, and that's going to be the ambush. Joshua, the main force, is going to come up here and draw them out. And then the ones behind are going to come burn the city. And then they'll be trapped in there out in the field. So that's the plan that God is giving them. Notice verse 2, Joshua 8 and verse 2, that you shall take its spoil and its cattle and its plunder. So Ai, now you can go do the very thing that was forbidden in Jericho. Okay, let me ask you a question. If you were reading through the Bible, somebody that's not familiar with these stories or new to the Bible, and they said, why is it okay now to take the plunder, but it wasn't okay at Jericho? What would you say?
Fruits of the spoil, and just like the first fruits of any endeavor, they go to God.
Okay.
And that's what Jericho was. And then from then on, it was to the people. God shared what he gave them. He had already promised them that they'd live in houses they didn't build, eat from crops they didn't grow, have animals they didn't raise, and that all would be really good with him. Achan just needed to be patient for God's promise to unfold.
Yeah, if he had just waited for the second battle, he could have had his precious metals or whatever was in Ai. Okay, that's good. I hadn't even thought of that principle, first fruits. Wyatt?
Even more simply, God makes the rules.
God makes the rules. It's because God said so. You know, he said not to do it in Jericho. He said to do it, or you're allowed to do it with Ai. So it's as simple as that. So it's just another reminder. God makes the rules. God defines right and wrong. Good lesson for us there. Why are some things okay during one period of time and not okay during another? Why did God tell them to be circumcised for a long period of time from Abraham to Acts chapter 2? The males of Israel must be circumcised. And then after that, then do not get circumcised for religious reasons. In fact, Paul says, if you receive circumcision, Christ will be of no benefit to you. Galatians 5:2. Why does God want it here and not here? Because that's what God said. God gets to make the rules. God decides what's right. We make the same point when we talk about instruments of music as worship under the old covenant. Why did God command it under the old covenant, 2 Chronicles 29:25, but not under the new covenant? I don't know. I just know it was commanded under the old, not under the new. And that's what we have to go on. So it's God's prerogative. God's the one in authority setting forth whatever rules he wants, whenever he wants. And he can change them back and forth at his discretion. So just wanted to make that quick point from verse 2. Let's keep reading. Verse 3, so Joshua rose up with all the people of war to go to Ai, and Joshua chose 30,000 men, valiant warriors, and sent them out at night. He commanded them, saying, see that you are going to ambush the city from behind it. Do not go very far from the city, but all of you be ready. Then I and all the people who are with me will approach the city, and when they come out to meet us at the first, we will flee before them. They will come out after us until we have drawn them away from the city, and they will say, they are fleeing before us as at the first, so we will flee before them. And you shall rise from your ambush and take possession of the city, for the Lord your God will deliver it into your hand. Then it will be when you have seized the city that you shall set the city on fire. You shall do it according to the word of the Lord. See, I have commanded you. Okay, so verses 1 and 2 were God's instructions, and then now we have Joshua talking to the people. Here's what's going to happen. Unlike Jericho, there are actually some military tactics here. He's setting up an ambush. Of course, the victory is going to come because of God's intervention. Okay, comments on any of that so far? First 8 verses. Okay, so now they're going to fight Ai and defeat Ai. Look in verse 12. And he took about 5,000 men and set them in ambush between Bethel and Ai on the west side of the city. So they stationed the people, all the army that was on the north side of the city, and its rear guard on the west side of the city. And Joshua spent that night in the midst of the valley. It came about when the king of Ai saw it, and that the men of the city hurried and rose up early and went out to meet Israel in battle, he and all his people, at the appointed place before the desert plain. But he did not know that there was an ambush against him behind the city. And Joshua and all the people, Israel, pretended to be beaten before them and fled by the way of the wilderness, and all the people who were in the city were called together to pursue them, and they pursued Joshua and were drawn away from the city. So not a man was left in Ai or Bethel who had not gone out after Israel, and they left the city unguarded and pursued Israel. Then the Lord said to Joshua, stretch out the javelin that's in your hand toward Ai, for I will give it into your hand. So Joshua stretched out the javelin that was in his hand toward the city. Okay, so they draw the citizens of Ai out of the city, and then they spring the ambush from behind. Notice verse 18, how involved God is in this. He is so involved that he's telling Joshua when to spring the trap, when to spring the ambush, hold out your javelin, and give the signal. So God is very much involved in the battle tactics and in the battle itself as it proceeds. In verse 19, Joshua rose quickly from their place, stretched out his hand, they ran and entered the city and captured it, and they quickly set the city on fire. But when the men of Ai turned back and looked, behold, the smoke of the city ascended to the sky, and they had no place to flee this way or that, for the people who had been fleeing to the wilderness turned against the pursuers. When Joshua and all Israel saw that the men in ambush had captured the city and that the smoke of the city ascended, they turned back and slew the men of Ai. The others came out from the city to encounter them, so that they were trapped in the midst of Israel, some on this side and some on that side. And they slew them until no one was left of those who survived or escaped. Okay, so they're trapped. They're in big trouble. Again, here's that picture of AI was maybe either here or on this hill over here. So if you can imagine the force, let's say it's right here, and they're coming down this slope to go meet the main Israelite force down here, and they're chasing them. They're thinking they're winning. Then the ambush force comes from behind and sets the city on fire, and then they look back and they know they're in big trouble at that point. So ambush, highly successful. Obviously, God's with them this time, and it's going to be successful. And they're trapped outside of their city, and it's over after that. And then verse 25, all who fell that day, both men and women, were 12,000, all the people of Ai. So just a terrible slaughter. And God has said at the beginning of all this, I'm wiping out these idolatrous people. And so that's exactly what happens here. Verse 27, Israel took only the cattle and the spoil of that city as plunder for themselves, according to the word of the Lord, which he had commanded Joshua. So notice, they're following the instructions of the Lord here. No one disobeyed like Achan had at Jericho. And then verse 29, he hanged the king of Ai on a tree until evening, and at sunset, Joshua gave command, and they took his body down from the tree and threw it at the entrance of the city gate and raised over it a heap of stones that stands to this day. Okay, so everybody's killed, the king and everybody else. Okay, so Ai, an important lesson for Israel. God is not going to give them victory unless they obey him. And they see that from the sin of Achan. This is a small little town, but they lost in that first skirmish because God was not with them. So this was all God's doing. When they purged that sin of Achan from the camp, God gives them victory. And so that's a great lesson. It doesn't matter if it's a big, strong city like Jericho, these big old walls, God's going to make the walls fall down, no problem. Or if it's a little bitty town like Ai, you're going to lose if God's not with you. So great lesson for the nation of Israel. Okay, I'm going to read the last few verses here, but let me pause here again for comments. Mark?
I think it's interesting that even though God allowed them to be defeated the first time, he used that as part of the victory the second time because God knew that this would get resolved. He trained the men of Ai to think, oh, we're just going to get this small force. You know, the first time we were able to run them off, so let's just do the same thing the second time, except the second time, we're all going to get after them and wipe them out because we're tired of being annoyed with these people, and that was the downfall.
God pretty wise in his tactics here. Okay, anything else? Sir?
Very much a deception. And in fact, it was used as a model for the Battle of Coppins in the American Revolution. Okay. And to great success. It was basically a pivotal point in the Revolutionary War towards the end. Okay. And so it was exactly that. It was a deception. And yet we're told not to be deceivers. Is there a problem with that?
Well, that's so easy. I'm going to let you answer since you brought it up.
One that makes his way through life deceiving people. And that's what a deceiver is. However, deception is a tool to be used in a proper time and place. If God did it, then it's not the wrong thing to do. But God didn't go through all of the history between him and man deceiving us. He used that deception to further his nation, the people that he chose, and seeing to the fulfillment of his promise.
Okay. Well, God did right, so we know that much. So appreciate your comments with that. And deceptive tactics here used and draws them out, and they defeat them through that. So God using his wisdom to gain the victory there. Okay, let's look at these last few verses of chapter 8. They're going to go up here to Shechem between these two mountains or hillsides and read the law. In verse 30, Joshua 8 and verse 30, then Joshua built an altar to the Lord, the God of Israel, in Mount Ebal. So this is an interesting turn of the story. So here's where they've been, Jericho and Gilgal down here. They came a few miles over here to Ai and Bethel, this area. But then this area up here is 20 or 30 miles to the north of that. And so again, they're marching through hostile territory in this hill country to go up there and read the law, which is an interesting thing. But remember chapter 5 and verse 1, the people of the land are terrified of them. So nobody's going to mess with them while they're marching way up there away from their home base back here. So they go up there and they're going to read the law. Look in verse 31. Just as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded the sons of Israel, as is written in the book of the law of Moses, an altar of uncut stones on which no man had wielded an iron tool. They offered burnt offerings on it to the Lord and sacrificed peace offerings. He wrote there on the stones a copy of the law of Moses, which he had written in the presence of the sons of Israel. All Israel with his elders and officers and their judges were standing on both sides of the ark before the Levitical priests who carried the ark of the covenant of the Lord, the strangers as well as the native. Half of them stood in the front of Mount Gerizim and half of them stood in front of Mount Ebal, just as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had given command at first to bless the people of Israel. Then afterward, he read all the words of the law, the blessing and the curse, according to all that is written in the book of the law. There was not a word of all that Moses had commanded which Joshua did not read before all the assembly of Israel, with the women and the little ones and the strangers who were living among them. Okay, so how much of the law is he's inscribing this on the stones and then he's reading it to them. So how much of the law did he inscribe on the stones? Is he talking about just the Ten Commandments? Is he talking about, I mean, the entire law, Genesis through Deuteronomy? That's a lot to inscribe on stones. Is he talking about just the law parts? Like not the narrative parts of Genesis through Deuteronomy, but just the laws? Is he talking about just the blessings and cursing? You see blessing and cursing mentioned there in verse 34. And the answer is, I'm not sure. The law was written on the stones. I know that much. Whatever it was, they inscribed on the stones, and then he reads it while all of Israel is listening. And this appears to be separate stones. There are some stones for the altar and then separate stones set up for the writing based on Deuteronomy 27, I think. But we studied this back when we went through Deuteronomy 27. You notice it kept mentioning, this is what Moses commanded. And that was back in Deuteronomy 27, when Moses looked forward to this time and said, you're going to go to this place and you're going to go through this ritual here. We don't have time to go back and read from Deuteronomy 27. But they're standing on those two mountains. You remember these pictures? Mount Gerizim and Mount Ebal and Shechem is the area in between there. And six tribes are on one side, six tribes on the other. And they stay in the middle and they read this. And this is where J.W. McGarvey came in the 1800s and stood in the middle there and read from Deuteronomy 27 and had a couple of buddies go stand over here and here. And they could hear him. I don't know, it's something about the acoustics in that area. And I don't know if God helped Joshua's voice be louder or what. But anyway, read the law as Israel is listening there and dedicating themselves to God's law. They also built an altar. Now, they found an altar on Mount Ebal over in this area. And, you know, it's one of those things, hard to know if that's the altar from this event or not, or if it was just some unrelated altar. But there it is. There's still an altar over there. So I don't know. Are those uncut stones? I don't know if this is the same altar or not. But this is where they found this little tablet. You remember we've talked about this before? So they sifted through the dirt and everything that they got out of this altar, and they found this tiny little tablet. When they scan that tablet through there, they don't want to open it. They're afraid it'll break into a million pieces. It says this. It appears to say this in early Hebrew writing. You are cursed by the God Yahweh, cursed. You will die. Cursed, cursed. You will surely die. Cursed you are by Yahweh, cursed. Okay, so that would certainly fit what they were going to say there. Deuteronomy 27, the blessings and the curses. If that's what that is, that it would be the oldest Hebrew writing ever to be found. And maybe it's connected to what happened here, Joshua chapter 8. All right, let's look at chapter 9 real quick before we run out of time. This is the Gibeonite deception. Chapter 9, verse 1, it came about when all the kings who were beyond the Jordan and the hill country and in the lowland and all the coasts of the great sea toward Lebanon, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Canaanite, Perizzite, Hivite, and Jebusite heard of it, that they gathered themselves together with one accord to fight with Joshua and with Israel. Okay, we're going to pick up those stories in chapters 10, 11, and 12, those that want to fight. I think it's mentioned here because, by contrast, the Gibeonites have another strategy. We're going to pretend we're from far away, and we're going to go try to make a covenant with them, a deceptive covenant with the Israelites. And so that's what happens. Verse 3, when the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai, they also acted craftily and set out as envoys and took worn-out sacks on their donkeys and wineskins worn out and torn and mended and worn out and patched sandals on their feet and worn-out clothes on themselves, and all the bread of their provisions was dry and had become crumbled. And they went to Joshua to the camp at Gilgal and said to him and to the men of Israel, we have come from a far country. Now, therefore, make a covenant with us. Okay, so they pretend to be far away. Now let me zoom in on the map. Here's Gilgal, Jericho. They attacked Ai. Then they went up here to Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim and did the reading of the law. Now they're back here. Here's Gibeon right here. They're right next door. They're not from far away. They're right there. And so these people from Gibeon are coming over here and saying, look at our bread. It's all crusty and musty, and we're from a long way away. And they don't check with God. Joshua doesn't think we should ask God about this. And so in verse 14, so the men of Israel took some of their provisions and did not ask for the counsel of the Lord. Joshua made peace with them and made a covenant with them to let them live. And the leaders of the congregation swore an oath to them. So that was the big mistake. They didn't ask God, what should we do here? You would think that right after Achan and Ai and everything that's happened, you would ask for God's blessing before doing anything. But they don't think to do that, and it gets them in a big mess here. Verse 16, it came about at the end of 3 days after they had made a covenant with them that they heard that they were neighbors and that they were living within their land. Then the sons of Israel set out and came to their cities on the third day. Now their cities were Gibeon and Chephira and Beeroth and Kiriath-Jearim. The sons of Israel did not strike them because the leaders of the congregation had sworn to them by the Lord, the God of Israel. And the whole congregation grumbled against the leaders. But all the leaders said to the whole congregation, we have sworn to them by the Lord, the God of Israel, and now we cannot touch them. This we will do to them, even let them live, so that wrath will not be upon us for the oath which we swore to them. The leaders said to them, let them live. So they became hewers of wood and drawers of water for the whole congregation, just as the leaders had spoken to them. Okay, so that essentially wraps up that story. It only takes 3 days to figure out, they tricked us. And now they say, well, we made an oath, so I guess we're not going to mess with them, but they'll just be our slaves. And Gibeon is, they accept, you know, they know they're going to be dead otherwise. So they say, yeah, make us slaves. And so the Gibeonites accept verse 25. Great lesson on leadership, by the way, verse 18. The whole congregation grumbled against the leaders. So when you make a decision without thinking it through fully, a lot of times you make the wrong decision and people are going to be upset about that, understandably. And so that's exactly what happens here. Okay, we got about 3 minutes. Questions, comments? What observations do you have from these stories, J.D.?
I was just trying to picture what it would have been like for the people of the land to see Israel going up to Yeah, 20 miles. If there were a million Israelites, they would have been a column stretched from there all the way back to Gilgal, the width of this auditorium, spacing. If everyone is as close, if the auditorium is full, that's how close they would be spaced.
Wow. That's a lot of people.
Yeah. You can see why people's hearts were melted. And other people are thinking, we got to get together and fight. And then Gibeon says, we're going to try to trick them and make peace. Interesting. Here's a Bible drill slide I have for the kids. How the Gibeonites tricked Joshua. Old torn clothes and old stale bread. They tricked him. Okay, what else? Yeah.
He's just getting his feet wet and leading the people, and they have a great victory to start out with. He's been told to be strong, courageous, and then immediately get defeated by this little piddling town.
A couple of missteps early on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And these are high-stakes things. You know, big things happen. Tori?
And I'm thinking, how could they have communicated? Because they didn't speak the same language, correct?
Oh, the Gibeonites and the Israelites?
I don't know. They didn't have Google Translate back then. How
they? They wouldn't have. They maybe had could speak some Egyptian because of like they pass on maybe the Egyptian language. But
there must have been something in common.
I hadn't
thought about that.
And maybe I don't know if there's traders going around back then that would have known a bunch of languages and could act as a translator. It's a good question. Hannah?
Sometimes people in closer areas have the same base to their language.
Okay. So they could have made out what they were communicating, especially with hand gestures along with it.
German.
Well, okay.
pretty similar languages.
That may have been something like that. I don't know. You get the last word.
My mom's dad, grandpa, lived in Europe, and he was a train conductor. And so they went through, and you know, small countries, and they went through multiple countries. He knew about four or five different languages. Because ever stopped, he had to use a different language. So I guess people that travel a lot might, you know, pick up a lot of this variety.
Okay.
All right, good. Well, thank you for your attention. I'll be out next week. Brother Smitherman's going to bring a lesson for us, and then I'll plan to be back the week after that. Thanks for your attention tonight.